Healthy alternatives. Both research and real-life experiences are making it clear every day that our traditional medical system and practices need to be rethought, revised, and recharged in light of a more holistic approach to health. Dr. Jerry V. Teplitz, host of Healthy Alternatives, has been a pioneer for 36 years in stress management and optimum health. With a Ph.D. in holistic health sciences, a law degree, and as the author of 8 books, all focused on health, stress management, and performance, Dr. Teplitz is uniquely qualified to help us explore and incorporate healthy alternatives into our daily lives. He is a professional speaker and has shared his wisdom with over 1 million people. Join him to reach your highest level of health and wellness. Now, here's Dr. Teplitz.
Welcome to Healthy Alternatives. I'm Dr. Jerry Teplitz, and you're listening to WebTalkRadio.net. What Healthy Alternatives is about, most of us really want to reach optimum levels of health and wellness. We want to feel better, live long, and enjoy life even more, and that's what I attempt to bring you on each of the Healthy Alternative shows. My guest I'm going to be talking to a little bit is Dr. Eben Alexander. He's been an academic neuroscientist for the last 25 years, and he's been at Brigham and Women's and Children's Hospitals. He's taught at Harvard Medical School. He's authored over 150 chapters and papers in peer-reviewed journals. And he also had a near-death experience that totally changed his way of looking at how the brain, the body, and the mind operate. And he's written a book called Proof of Heaven. We're going to be talking to him a little bit about his experience and what that has meant for him and what it means for you. We'll be back with Dr. Alexander in just a couple of minutes. Every week, I like to begin the show by talking about an issue or concern you should know about because it can have a real impact on you. What I want to talk about are mammograms, CT scans, x-rays. There's recent reports reporting that there are too many diagnostic tests being done on adults, and that some of these tests not only can cause cancer in children, but they can induce new cancers in children who are being treated for cancers. Some of this comes from researches from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. And what they did is they found that girls who receive radiation to the chest to treat childhood cancer have a high risk of developing cancer at a young age. Even those who receive low doses of common cancer treatments for the face had increased risk of breast cancer later. What the researchers did, they analyzed data from 1,300 cancer survivors from the Childhood Cancer Survivor Study, and they found that they followed up for 26 years. 175 of the nearly 1,300 cancer survivors later developed breast cancer at a median age of 38. Proposed solution to getting these higher levels of cancer developing later is to begin mammogram screenings earlier for women who receive radiation treatments in their youth, which will actually then increase their risk of getting cancer. See, mammograms expose the body to ionized radiation that can be 1,000 times greater than that from just a chest x-ray. Some of the research done on this has reported that women following the current guidelines for premenopausal screening of their mammary glands had over a 10-year period that she'd receive a total dose of 5 rads. That's the approximate radiation of a Japanese woman 1 mile from the epicenter where the atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Dr. Robert Kaplan, who's chairman of the Department of Health Services at the School of Public Health at the University of California, Los Angeles, found 22% more invasive breast tumors in the group who had mammograms every 2 years compared to a group who just had one mammogram over a 6-year period. Also, with CT scans, while they can produce life-saving images of head injuries, complicated pneumonia, chest infections, a child who's exposed to the radiation just for 2 or 3 scans will triple their risk of developing brain cancer later on in life. 5 to 10 scans were found to triple the risk of leukemia. You have to realize that there is a scientific debate about whether low doses of radiation, like those from a CT scan, do increase cancer risks. And this study that was reported in the British Medical Journal Lancet is the first one to provide a direct evidence of a link, and they were able to quantify that risk. A study last year also found that 1.6 million children got a CT scan during their visits to emergency room in 2008, which is a 5-fold increase in 14 years. So if your doc wants to do a CT scan on a kid, ask first of all for the lowest dose of radiation possible. B, avoid multiple scans. And C, ask them to do an ultrasound or MRI instead, because there's no radiation at all from that. So we need to be looking, because there's $100 billion spent annually on the high cost of imaging. Doctors have a motivation for doing mammograms and CT scans. You need to protect yourself. You need to protect your kids by asking some real questions about options and whether or not it's actually necessary. If you want to know more about me, Dr. Jerry Teplitz, you can go to teplitz.com, and you can follow me on Twitter and Facebook. I do a free monthly newsletter that you can sign up for at teplitz.com, teplitz.com. When you get to the home page, you'll see the Home About button, and just click there. You get a drop down. You can sign up there. Every week, I also like to talk about a healthy breakthrough. The newest discoveries and latest information about healthy alternatives you can use for yourself, your family, and loved ones. What I want to talk to you about is research by Natasha Campbell McBride. And she has looked at how your gut affects your immune system. You may not be aware, but about 85% of your immune system is actually located in your gut wall. Your gut, your digestive wall, it's actually the biggest and the most important immune organ in your body. The cells in your gut actually have a 10-to-1 ratio over the cells in our body. There are 10 times more cells in our gut than in our body, and most of these are these bacteria that actually assist us. What the gut bacteria is doing is actually help form immune cells that will really assist our immune system functioning. See, there are two primary parts of our immune system in the gut. One is what's called Th1 immunity, and that's responsible for normal reaction to anything in your environment, from pollen to animal dandruff, dust mites, chemicals, foods. If it's kept robust and healthy by your gut flora, and as long as it's in this normal level, you don't have any adverse symptoms when exposed to these kinds of environmental influences. If your gut flora is abnormal, then Th1 becomes disabled. There's also Th2 immunity. That's designed to kind of address the bigger picture of immunity inside your body, and it's not really equipped to handle environmental influences. However, if your Th1 becomes disabled, the Th2 will attempt to take it over, except it's not really designed to do that effectively. Food allergies and intolerance is a very different group of allergies from the more acute things like anaphylactic allergies. And food allergies and food intolerances are caused by a disabled Th1. And so when you have Th2, you're actually not having a good response by the body to these allergies. So according to Dr. McBride, The key to resolving your health issues that you might have is not determining which foods you're reacting to in order to avoid them. Rather, you need to focus on healing your gut lining, because this is the most likely the root cause of your problem. And she said that we actually have in our body antibodies to deal with all kinds of things like multiple sclerosis, ALS, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, a whole range of things, but they wind up getting disabled when your gut flora goes out of whack. How do you get your gut flora back into shape? Well, you could look at taking probiotics, and some of them contain about 10 billion colony-forming units within it. However, there's an even better option, and that is using fermented vegetables, because you're now talking about 10 trillion colony-forming bacteria. So going from 10 billion to 10 trillion colony-forming bacteria. Now, you do have to be aware when you're starting fermented foods is you need to do it very gradually, because they are so powerful. They can cause a die-off reaction of the bacteria, the fungus, the viruses in your body can die off. And when they do die off, they release chemicals that can be dangerous to you. So if you've never had fermented food in your life, you need to start very carefully, very gradually. Just one teaspoon of fermented vegetables, such as sauerkraut, with just one of your meals, and then wait a couple of days, see how you react. And if it was okay, then you can gradually start increasing your portion. So you need to take a look at the notion of fermented vegetables as a way to get your body back in shape. Before I bring on my guest, Dr. Eben Alexander, I'd like to talk to you about a book I've done called Switched On Networking. This is a book that went to bestseller on Amazon, and I did it with Donna Fisher, who's an expert in networking. In every chapter, she focuses in on what you need to do from a technique standpoint, whether it's social media networking or face-to-face networking. What I do is a concept called brain rewiring, to switch your brain off to be able to do immediately what Donna suggests you do to be more effective. It's a fabulous book. It can really assist you. All you have to do to get it is go to switchedonnetworking.com. That's switchedonnetworking.com. Or you can get it also on amazon.com.
My guest today is Dr. Eben Alexander III. He's an academic neurosurgeon. He's been one for the last 25 years, including 15 years at the Brigham and Women's and the Children's Hospitals. He's also been at Harvard Medical School in Boston. Over his academic career, he's authored and co-authored over 150 chapters and papers in peer-reviewed journals. He's made over 200 presentations at conferences around the world. Now, since he's a neurosurgeon, he thought he knew how the brain and mind worked. Well, he got interrupted in this by having a transcendental near-death experience where he was basically just about dead, spent a week in a coma, and came back from it. And in his book, he talks about his experience, and the book is called Proof of Heaven. He was recently interviewed on Oprah's Super Soul Sunday show and appeared on a special episode of Super Soul Sunday, which was looking at life's big questions about soul-to-soul answers that Oprah has gotten over the years from many authors and teachers. And so, Dr. Alexander, welcome to Healthy Alternatives.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
So, you're a neurosurgeon, and what was your belief about kind of illness and what happens and what happens when we die and where we go and all that stuff?
Well, I would say that I grew up in a religious family. My father was a neurosurgeon. He was very much a scientist, but he had strong faith. And so for many years, I hoped there would be an afterlife. I thought there might be some power to prayer. But over 20 years in neurosurgery, less and less was I able to see any way that any kind of consciousness could survive the death of the brain and body. And that was my belief going into this. And when I went into coma back in 2008, that's what I would have told you, is that consciousness depends on the brain, and when the brain dies, that's the end.
And now what happened that got you into the coma?
Well, it's still something we have no explanation for. My doctors never found a cause. Very suddenly, on the morning of November 10th, 2008, I came down with severe bacterial meningitis. Within about 4 hours, went deep into coma, had a grand mal seizure that was unbreakable initially, and spent the next 7 days on a ventilator in an ICU with diminishing signs of any kind of brain activity. My neocortex, the outer part of the brain that makes us human, was inactivated really from the first few hours. But then I was even having damage to my brain stem as the week went on. By the end of the week, my doctors said I had about a 2 or 3% chance of survival, but no chance of recovery, and at best would spend a few months in hospital, then the rest of my life in a nursing home in chronic care in a persistent vegetative state.
Not a good diagnosis.
No, it was a very terrible prognosis, and my family really went through a very, very tough time.
Now, what happened in the experience that you had while you were in coma?
Well, I think it's important to say that if you'd asked me before my coma, how much would a patient that's that seriously ill and close to death, how much would they experience or remember, I would have told you nothing at all. And that's why having a very rich experience when I came out of coma that I remembered was astonishing. But in the middle of coma, deep down inside, I had no memory of my life, no memories whatsoever of humans or life on Earth, no identity, because I think the meningitis had done such a beautiful job of wiping out my cortex, the part that makes us human, that I really had no memory or anything of a life that I'd been through. And that temporary amnesia from my life was very useful. Deep in coma, I had initially a very kind of monotonous, pounding, foamy, unresponsive realm that I call the earthworm's eye view. But then I was rescued by this lovely spinning white light and melody, a perfect melody, into a lovely gateway valley filled with flowers and angels, a beautiful girl on a butterfly wing, and all kinds of things that I discuss very much in the book. Very earthly and yet also ultra real, much more real than earthly reality. And then launched totally out of the higher dimensional multiverse, outside of all of space and time, into what I call the core, infinite inky blackness, but with a divine, all-loving, all-powerful deity, and also with this beautiful orb of brilliant light. And I cycled through those realms several times, which I discuss in the book.
So in having this experience, you were able to remember it, even though you had pretty much no brain functioning or very minimal brain functioning while you're in coma.
Exactly. And of course, that was a gigantic mystery when I first came out of it all, is where did all this come from? And how in the world did I remember it? I had no explanation for that based on everything I knew about neuroscience, everything I knew about consciousness. And yet, that's exactly what I had. So somehow I had to understand it all.
And so what did it actually teach you about consciousness then?
Well, I would say initially I was as blown away by the experience, the ultra reality and the significance and the meaning of it, just as are millions of others who have had near-death experiences. But of course, my doctors would say, oh, well, you were very sick, and we can't even believe you've come back. Your brain was completely wrecked by this infection, so we have no idea how you had any of this experience. But, you know, the dying brain does all kinds of crazy things, so you can just forget about it. And I assumed, okay, but it was so shocking, it was too real to be real. So I wanted to explain it as a neuroscientific explanation and see how that could happen in the brain, especially with severe meningitis when my cortex was shut down. And that started a very long journey of recording the whole experience and then learning much more about other near-death experiences and then trying to understand what it told me about consciousness. And in fact, what it told me after I went through 9 hypotheses and realized none of them could explain it based on the brain is that it really happened, and it seemed hyper-real because of that, that it did happen, but it did not happen in my brain, nor did it happen in the physical universe. And it shows a tremendous amount about the nature of consciousness and about the eternity of our spirit or soul and about quantum mechanics and the whole issue of reality and consciousness.
I think one of the interesting pieces is you as a neurosurgeon, that you lost your brain basically and had this whole experience where has it made it harder for medical doctors to poo-poo what you're saying over this because it's so out of their normal realm?
Well, you know, I would say that most doctors and certainly many nurses, especially ICU and hospice nurses, have seen things happen around the time that a patient makes a transition and their physical body and brain die, to realize there's something else going on there. It's not simply the end of, you know, an individual, but there seems to be something far more kind of powerful and mystical and spiritual going on there, that our materialist models, and especially models that the brain gives rise to consciousness, and when the brain and body dies, that's the end of it all, those models are really no good at all. They do not explain what so many healthcare workers and family members and patients themselves who have gone there and come back, what so many report. And I think that's the real power behind this. And the more that physicians know about consciousness, and the more they've been around patients making the transition, the more easily they come to realize that my journey really is simply helping us to understand a far more profound aspect of our reality of existence than we did before.
What were your family's and your close friends' reaction when you first started telling them the story of your experience?
Well, it turns out that, I first was mentioning it to doctors and a little bit to family, but then my older son came home 2 days after I got out of the hospital. He was majoring in neuroscience. And he said, if you want this to be of any value at all, you need to write down everything you can remember and don't read anything about near-death experiences or physics or cosmology, and don't talk with anyone who was there until you've written it all down. That was excellent advice. I spent the next 6 weeks writing down everything I could remember, about 20,000 words of the experience deep in coma. And that was really kind of my database with which I could work. And that has helped me tremendously in coming to an understanding about what all this means and what it tells us about consciousness.
How did you feel when you did start looking at the near-death literature and started meeting other folks who've had those kinds of experiences that feel like, you know, friends coming home type of thing?
Well, you know, at the end of those 6 weeks when I had written everything down, I had not read the NDE literature, near-death experience literature, and once I started reading it, I was really blown away by the similarities. And in fact, it extended way beyond that to reading mystical and religious prophets and afterlife literature going back 3,000 years, and realizing that we're really all discussing the very same realm that is unchanging, and yet is every bit as real, and in fact, those who've been there would testify much more real than this realm, because it's the basis for this realm. And it was that understanding, especially combined with knowing of the hard problem of consciousness, which many scientists will tell you is the most profound problem known to all of human thinking, which basically says that we have not the remotest idea how consciousness could emerge from the physical brain. And in the last few decades, neuroscience has actually gotten much closer to realizing that hard problem is probably completely insoluble forever by physicalist, materialist thinking about brain and mind, and not closer to solving it. And the more people realize that, that this giant white elephant in the room, that modern neuroscience and materialist science has absolutely no clue how consciousness could come out of the physical brain, the more they can realize that my story helps to show what's really going on here and about the eternity of our soul and spirit.
So before we continue, we're going to take a brain break for you to think about what we're talking about. And I'd like to remind you, you're listening to Healthy Alternatives with Dr. Jerry Teplitz on webtalkradio.net. And we'll be back with my guest, Dr. Eben Alexander III, in just a moment.
What if you could have more energy to accomplish the things you want in your life? What if you could take those stresses coming at you and negate them immediately? What if you could actually use your mind and your body to accomplish more than you ever thought possible? There's a book I've done called Switched On Living, which is designed to show you an area called behavioral kinesiology, which is muscle checking of the body. Everything around us affects us. Its effect is direct, immediate, and very dramatic. If you've never seen my programs, you can go on my website at teplitz.com, look at some of the videos. You can also get my book, which is on the website teplitz.com under products, called Switched On Living, which shows you all these techniques you can do immediately for yourself to wind up making every day be a high-energy, positive day for yourself.
So my guest today is Dr. Eben Alexander. He's an academic neurosurgeon, been one for the last 25 years. He's been at children's hospitals and Harvard Medical School. He's written over 150 chapters and papers in peer-reviewed journals, made over 200 presentations, and then he wound up having a near-death experience from having severe bacterial meningitis, and we've been talking to him about his journey. And so, Dr. Alexander, how does your near-death experience, once you started looking at the literature, differ from other folks' near-death experience, and how does it add to our overall understanding of this whole experience?
Well, I think the most important feature by far is the fact that I had a very severe bacterial meningitis. It was very prolonged. And any doctor who has worked with patients with bacterial meningitis will tell you that if a patient goes into a coma rapidly, which I did within about 4 hours, and they have a gram-negative bacterial meningitis, that just coming in the ER with that story, their survival expectancy is already below 10%. And then I went on the next few days on a ventilator with deteriorating neurologic status. And basically by the sixth day, I was down to about a 2 or 3% chance of survival with no chance of recovery. And even if I did survive, best expectation was 3 months in the hospital and then months or a year or two in a nursing home, chronic care, in a vegetative state until I finally died. And so, in fact, it's just a real total miracle that I was able to come back from all of that. And that's a huge part of understanding why I should have had absolutely no experience whatsoever and yet had this very rich experience, which tells us a tremendous amount about the true nature of consciousness and the relationship of mind to brain.
And from what I understand from reading some of the near-death experience literature, lots of other people have had very short periods of time when they've quote-unquote died before they came back, and yours kind of in terms of brain function was a very, very long period. Is that one of the differences also?
Well, that is, I think, an important difference. I actually look at many near-death experiences as being of great value. I think all of them teach us tremendous things about this reality, the underlying reality of that spiritual realm. And it's important to understand that, in fact, what my experience should do is open the door so that people believe that there's a very real basis to these experiences. And, of course, a lot of the skeptics get hung up because they hear about earthly things, like in my journey, having a beautiful girl and butterflies and flowers blossoming and angels above. But they fail to recognize that we're stuck with earthly language when we come back to describe these things. And that, you know, most people say that it's very much indescribable, although I felt pretty good about some of the words I used to describe it. And then they fail to recognize that this might very well, as my story points out, show a realm that is true and real. And yet, for instance, a Christian who goes there comes back and they might see a light body, a beautiful being, and say, well, it must have been Jesus. And of course, a Muslim might say it was Muhammad. And you got to remember that our earthly brain and mind does some kind of overlay and tainting of memories as we come back from there. But don't take that to mean that that realm does not truly exist. Just because we're stuck with earthly language and that our brain does a little bit of kind of overlay. I think the most fascinating thing to me, especially in reading afterlife literature going back 3,000 years, was to realize that the similarities very much outweigh the differences.
Was it hard to come back because this realm you were in sounds like it was so, you know, otherworldly, you know, in some respects?
Well, it was... You know, it was difficult to come back because, yes, it is a very attractive realm. But, of course, I also know that we don't stay there forever. When you leave this incarnation, reincarnation must be a huge part of the overall package. So we come back over and over. And that's a piece of advice to any of those who are very depressed and contemplating suicide. It's not like you get there forever. You have to come back and get it right. But it is very appealing, but I also realize a bunch more about the meaning of our existence and that, in fact, our souls really want to get down into this realm, the soul school, this imperfect realm, very kind of murky compared to the reality of that realm, because this is where we really get things done, and this is where we really manifest that unconditional love of the Creator and show compassion and forgiveness in spite of all the imperfections, evil, and injustice present in this world.
So what's been the best part, then, of coming back for you?
Well, I would say, you know, the best part is really just knowing this much higher purpose for our existence and knowing the reality of that all-loving God that's within each and every one of us. In fact, I knew everything I needed to know just by being conscious before my coma to know the reality of this, just like everybody can get there through deep meditation or centering prayer. You don't have to have a near-death experience. And it's the beauty of that connection that we share in the core of our consciousness with the divine that is such a wonderful gift. In fact, once I first figured out what this all really meant, which was several months after my coma, trying to keep that bottled up was almost impossible. And of course, I try to keep the lid on it, but it's just such an astonishing reality. And just like many people who have had NDEs, my life was very much changed. But, of course, I didn't buy that old line from the doctor, oh, the dying brain can do anything, because as my neuroscience training came back, I realized with severe bacterial meningitis, my brain could have done anything, but it certainly could not have done what it did in coma.
Because the parts of the brain that could do stuff like this were shut down, I gather.
Right, because there was just no way for... my neocortex soaking in pus. I mean, that's the extreme calculator of the brain that's able to manifest all the details of our conscious existence, according to our neuroscientific models. But that whole neocortex was inactivated. There may have been a few sputtering neurons here and there, but there was certainly no broad network that could have constructed anything remotely resembling the ultra-real existence that I witnessed deep in coma.
How has this experience changed you as a healer?
I would say it really has changed everything about my life and understanding. And certainly as a healer, I've come to realize I now see patients and myself and family and friends really as physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, and divine eternal beings, realize the networking of our of those eternal spiritual beings with each other, how we are here to help each other and to learn lessons that allow our ascendance in that outer realm, in that spiritual realm, and come to see hardship, difficulty, challenges such as disease or illness as opportunities for growth, that our souls are here to live through and to use as lessons here in Soul School in progressing in that outer realm. And that it really has to do with learning these deep lessons, and many of them come in the form of hardships and hurdles, that help us to serve as conduits for that unconditional love, love for ourselves and love for others. And in essence, so many of the world's problems would go away if we weren't so caught up in needing validation and needing to find that we are indeed loved, which we all are deep at the core, and we can all know that, you know, through the gift of desperation or centering prayer or deep meditation. We can all come in touch with these very same truths.
How would your family, do you think, describe you now versus before?
Well, I do know that they have told people I'm nicer. I don't know exactly how to address that, but I think, and of course I meditate an hour or two every day, and that tends to make me nicer and a little mellower. But I remember when my older son, Evan, came home 2 days after I got out of the hospital, I still had an IV line in at home getting antibiotics, and I had lost 18 pounds, and he took one look at me, but he was just shocked because he said there was like a light shining through me, that I was so much more aware and tuned in. And I think that that's something that a lot of people have noticed, and it certainly did make me far more aware of our existence, and I think aware of the eternal spiritual light being inside each and every one of us. And that's the way I see everybody now.
And so you're now viewing science and spirituality as kind of being able to strengthen each other then?
Absolutely. And I'm every bit the scientist I always have been. I now realize, of course, that science, the materialist scientific worldview, is far too limited. It's way too simple. It tends to tell people that it's so close to a theory of everything and yet is absolutely mute on the whole question of what is consciousness. And quantum mechanics has been yelling at us for 100 years to come to a better knowing of what consciousness and reality truly are and how they interact with each other. And yet the physics and the reductive materialist neuroscience communities have been completely unable to explain the depths of the mystery of consciousness. And I think that's the biggest clue to us as to the reality of the spiritual realm, is the very fact that no one on earth has the remotest idea how to describe the mechanism of consciousness emerging from the physical brain. And that's the hard problem of consciousness, the most profound question facing all of modern human knowing. And it's also a gigantic clue, that with the along with the enigma of quantum mechanics, that tell us that consciousness is a far deeper mystery than the materialist worldview postulates.
So for listeners who'd like to pursue what Dr. Alexander's talking about, you can look at getting his book, Proof of Heaven, and you can go to his website at lifebeyonddeath.net. That's lifebeyonddeath.net. Dr. Alexander, thanks for being a guest today on Healthy Alternatives.
Well, Jerry, thank you very much for having me. I hope you have a great day.
My guest next week is Meadow Lynn. She's a speaker, writer, and chef. She actually started her chefdom when she was 3 years old, and she created her first dish. She's the daughter of Denise Lynn, a world-renowned healer and teacher. When Meadow was 18, she, as a self-taught chef and lover of all things edible, started catering her mother's retreats, and she's been doing it ever since. She's written a book with her mother called The Mystic Cookbook, The Secret Alchemy of Food, and we're going to be talking to her about this notion of food and looking at it a different way that you've looked at it before and how it can be part of your spiritual journey. You're not going to want to miss this one. This is Dr. Jerry Teplitz. You can find out more about me at teplitz.com or you can follow me on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for being with us today for Healthy Alternatives. For more information about Dr. Teplitz and his availability for speaking engagements, please click on the globe on the webtalkradio.net page in front of you or go to teplitz.com. You may also follow him on Facebook and Twitter by using the icons on the page. To find out more about his books, please click on any of the book covers you see. Eat well, rest well, take a breath, get some exercise, and we'll see you again right here next week for another edition of Healthy Alternatives.